This is KMXT Kodiak, 100.1 FM. The weather for Kodiak is mostly cloudy, 46 degrees outside. Today, rain likely mainly after 3 p.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 41 degrees. South winds 5 to 10 miles per hour with a 60% chance of precipitation. And tonight, a 40% chance of rain, mainly before 9 p.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 36 degrees, and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming light and variable in the evening. Up next is the noon news report after NPR News. You'll hear about Alaska's plan to pay out nearly $50 million in the fishing industry for pandemic relief. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta faces a long road ahead. And how the University of Alaska Board of Regents voted Thursday for fundraising goals.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden's facing some backlash from members of his own party for authorizing U.S. strikes in Syria against Iran-backed militia. But the administration says the action was justified after last week's attack on U.S. allied forces in Iraq that killed a civilian contractor. Both Syria and Russia protested. More than 2 years after his disappearance, the remains of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi have yet to be found. But for the first time today, the U.S. has released a two-page report in which intelligence agencies conclude, based largely on circumstantial evidence, that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved Khashoggi's killing. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The report says the U.S. intelligence community bases its assessment that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman wanted to capture or kill Jamal Khashoggi on several factors. The royal has absolute control over decision-making in the kingdom, including its security and intelligence services. Members of his close inner circle were involved in the killing and dismemberment of Khashoggi. And the Crown Prince has supported the use of violent methods to silence dissidents abroad. The findings were compiled shortly after Khashoggi was killed, but the Trump administration refused to make them public. Saudi officials have long denied the Crown Prince was connected with the killing and say those responsible are now in prison. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
In an upcoming exclusive interview with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, the director of national intelligence acknowledges the report could complicate U.S.-Saudi relations. The head of the CDC is flagging a worrisome uptick in new coronavirus cases.
The most recent seven-day average of cases, approximately 66,350, is higher than the average I shared with you on Wednesday. In fact, cases have been increasing for the past 3 days compared to the prior week.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, warning that things are tenuous and now is not the time to relax coronavirus restrictions. Meanwhile, the national drive to speed up vaccinations may soon roll out a third vaccine, provided the FDA says it's good to go. NPR's Joe Palca says an advisory panel is reviewing Johnson & Johnson's application to secure emergency use authorization.
The Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee is a group of independent experts that the FDA calls on to advise them on vaccines. The agency is not required to ask for this committee's advice, but early on it said it would, as a way of fostering public confidence in the decision-making process. Studies of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have shown that it is effective in preventing serious COVID-19 disease and is safe to administer. If the committee votes in favor of the company's application for emergency use authorization, the FDA could grant that in a matter of days. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is NPR. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden are visiting Houston, Texas, where they were scheduled to survey damage from last week's devastating winter storms while also encouraging Texans to get vaccinated against COVID-19. An investigation is underway in Texas into the state's response to historically frigid temperatures that overwhelmed an infrastructure, causing millions of people to endure days of freezing weather without electricity or running water. Myanmar's ambassador to the United Nations is calling on the world body to use all means necessary to stop a military coup. The new U.S. ambassador says the U.S. stands in solidarity with him. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has details.
Ambassador Jomo Trun is urging U.N. members to back the civilian government he represents, the one led by de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who was jailed earlier this month.
The military coup is not acceptable in this modern world. And the coup must fail.
His statement drew applause in the General Assembly Hall. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield calls him and the protesters courageous.
The military has tried to silence those calls with social media and internet blackouts, but we still hear the people of Myanmar loud and clear.
The U.S. has imposed sanctions on the leaders of the coup. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed down 469 points, 1.4%, ending at 30,932. The Nasdaq has closed up more than 0.5%. S&P closed down roughly 0.5%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, the business insurance experts.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Alaska's plan to pay out nearly $50 million to the fishing industry for pandemic relief has been approved by the federal government. That's after two major revisions and more than 200 public comments from every industry sector, says Fish and Game Department Deputy Commissioner Rachel Baker.
And it really was a balance between getting the funds out quickly and developing a spending plan with the input of affected fishery participants.
Commercial applicants will need to show that the COVID-19 pandemic caused them at least 35% loss in revenue last year. Applications will be accepted during a two-month window that opens March 1st. Payments could come as early as June. Baker says the major change to the final plan now excludes commercial permit holders who live in Pacific states like Washington and Oregon.
Non-Alaska resident commercial harvesters who fish up here but live in a state that received a CARES Act allocation must apply to their state of residence. They're not eligible to apply to the state of Alaska for funds.
Non-resident charters are eligible, provided they have Alaska business license. The money comes from the original CARES Act that Congress passed last year. More than $17 million will go to commercial fishermen, $13 million for sport and charter guides, and nearly $500,000 from Alaska's aquaculture businesses. $2.5 million pot of money is reserved for rural houses that had pandemic related problems accessing subsistence fisheries. And the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta faces longer road ahead than other areas of the state and country before it can reach herd immunity against COVID-19 through vaccinations. As KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports, it's because the region has a young population.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is on a mission to get every eligible person in the region vaccinated against COVID-19 as soon as possible. YKHC opened vaccinations to the general population in mid-January. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's lead infectious disease expert, told the New York Times that from 70 to 90% of the U.S. population will need to be vaccinated against COVID to stop the virus's transmission. But under current guidelines, a large portion of the population is too young to receive a vaccine. The two vaccines with emergency use authorization in the U.S. are not approved for children. The Pfizer vaccine is approved for people age 16 and older, the Moderna vaccine for people age 18 and older. According to U.S. Census data, about a quarter of both the nation's and Alaska's population is too young to be vaccinated. And that percentage of young people in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is even higher. It's nearly 40% of the region's population. The percentage varies from village to village. Dr. Ellen Hodges, chief of staff for YKHC, says in some communities, half the population is too young for vaccination. But that could change in the coming months. Both Moderna and Pfizer have begun clinical trials to test their COVID vaccines in children. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Interior Gas Utility celebrated its newly completed $15 million North Pole natural gas storage facility Thursday with a ribbon-cutting ceremony at its site near the Flint Hills Resources Refinery. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
A half dozen or so dignitaries assembled Thursday morning at the site of the IGU's new North Pole LNG storage and vaporization facility to celebrate both its completion and the opening of its valves to begin distribution of gas to the city's customers who've signed up for the service. North Pole Mayor Mike Welch says the project was a long time coming.
I like to say good things come to those who wait. We've waited long enough and it's glad to have it here now.
Former North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward, who now serves as the Fairbanks North Star Borough's mayor, hailed the project as an important step toward extending the IGU's service area outside of Fairbanks.
It's been almost a decade of work that's gone towards the actual commencement of the gas and the lines here today. And really, it brings me a lot of excitement to say that the future of North Pole and the future of the interior is natural gas.
The IGU is a subsidiary of the borough, which has promoted natural gas as an essential component of the state's stringent plan to reduce Fairbanks area air pollution, mainly caused by emissions from wood stoves and other solid fuel home heating systems. Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Janelle Schwanier alluded to that, and the IGU's efforts to bring down the price of natural gas to make it more competitive with other fuels, especially heating oil.
Not only does this alternative fuel have the potential to lower costs for families in the long run, but will also help improve air quality in the area by reducing PM2.5 production from home heating.
That's been a challenge for the IGU, both because of the upfront cost for consumers to convert their home heating systems to natural gas, and because the low price of crude oil over the past couple of years has driven down the price of heating oil, the area's most widely used fuel. But IGU General Manager Dan Britton expects the new storage facility will make gas more competitive.
Today is a big step into the future of our community. North Pole is in dire need of a clean-burning energy source, and we're here to celebrate that today.
Britton said in an interview after the ribbon cutting that the North Pole facility came in on budget but not on schedule, in part due to COVID-related delays. He said the IGU has about 1,400 customers around Fairbanks, but only 5 in North Pole. But he expects that number will grow now that the new storage facility is up and running.
The whole idea is now to be able to add a significant number of new customers.
Britton says that's why IGU's installed some 72 miles of distribution lines around North Pole and 15 service lines last year.
With the increase in demand, we can further expand that system in the coming years.
Britton says the IGU's already gotten some applications for construction of more service lines around town. And he says the utility will be accepting applications for more lines through this summer. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents voted Thursday to give Anchorage's hockey and gymnastics teams more time to reach their fundraising goals. And the regents agreed that if the sports raise the funds, then they'll be reinstated. The unanimous decision gave UAA hockey coach Matt Curley a sense of relief.
So overall, very happy with the outcome and grateful for the opportunity to continue our quest towards reaching that mark.
UAA's hockey, gymnastics, and ski programs all found themselves on the chopping block last fall. To partially close the wide budget gap, regents voted to eliminate the sports effective this year. But they said if the teams could raise 2 years of their operating expenses by this month, they could stay. Skiing did just that and got reinstated. Meanwhile, gymnastics has raised roughly 40% of its nearly $1 million total, and hockey is about halfway to its $3 million goal. UA interim President Pat McPinney praised the teams for rallying much support.
I'm so excited about this. The momentum and the community support has been just remarkable.
The uncertainty brought by months of fundraising, however, did not come without setbacks. UAA hockey is expected to take out a season as, quote, pausing and planning year because, in part, it's needed to recruit almost an entirely new team, many players transferred to other schools. Hockey's new fundraising deadline is August 30th, while gymnastics needs to raise half of its total goal by this June and the other half by the following year. After over a year hiatus, the Silvertip Maintenance Station is up and running again. Silvertip covers a 60-mile stretch on the Seward Highway, including Turnagain Pass. The state wrote the station of its budget in 2019, but agreed to open it again in December following an outpouring of concern from commercial truck drivers, recreationists, and Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Machete. Since then, the station has been reopening slowly. The last year, four non-permanent employees came back last week.
The great thing is that we have these new employees that are just dedicated to the pass, dedicated to the Silvertip area.
Shannon McCarthy is a spokesperson for the Department of Transportation.
So that's Hope Road, it's Turnagain Pass, it's both sides, the north and the south. So we feel like we're in much better shape.
While the station was closed, operators in Girdwood and Crown Point picked up the slack. But between midnight and 4 a.m., a popular transport time for truck drivers, there was no operations on duty. Drivers said the inconsistent plowing made their commutes more dangerous. It was especially rough in January, and this area saw a lot of rain and snow. Now there's someone working at the station every hour of every day, McCarthy says.
Not everything is back in the Silvertip station yet, but we're moving everything back in. It does take some additional work in terms of like just making sure the supplies are there for our employees. We don't want to send them down there without, all the stuff that they need to work.
The department purchased new equipment for the station since it can take months to bring new machinery from outside. It's using coronavirus relief funding to pay current for Silvertip employees, but it hasn't worked out a long-term funding mechanism. That came up on a budget meeting Wednesday. Senator Machete asked DOT Deputy Commissioner Rob Carpenter why the departments made the decision to close Silvertip in the first place. Carpenter said shortfall in motor fuel tax revenue, even before the pandemic, was to blame for the reduced budget that shuttered the station.
I think it's that the agency's been, as our budget has been reduced, we're trying to adapt as well. And I think we got to a breaking point. And as the governor, and everybody, the demand, the public outcry was there enough to where, the situation reversed. But I agree with you. We should for sure bring it to the legislature's attention before we make any potential major decisions like this. And in the future, hopefully our maintenance funding will be stable.
Alaska's motor fuel tax, the lowest in the country, has historically sustained the department's maintenance stations and workers. There was a push to raise the tax last March, but it fell by the wayside when COVID-19 hit. McCarthy says the station would need about $6,050 in fiscal year 2022 to fully fund Silvertip. An Alaska Native corporation was barred from searching for oil in part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge this winter and is firing back against federal government. The Interior Department announced last week that Katkavit Inuit Corporation missed the deadline to do more airborne surveys for polar bear dens, which can be disturbed by heavy trucks searching for oil. The deadline for flights was February 13th. In strongly worded statement by KIC, argued that the governor mischaracterized why the deadline was missed. KIC says that it did not run out of time, the government did. It says it's been waiting on approval to conduct the flights from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service an Interior Department agency. KIC said the agency's, quote, negligence and irresponsibility and failure to do its job, unquote, led to the missed deadline. The Native Corporation is demanding an apology. The Interior Department said it has no comment on the KIC statement. Governor Dan Levy sent notice that he won't reappoint a Board of Game member whose term will expire this summer. Just this January, the board named Walker appointee Larry Van Deel as chair, but that too will expire. KDLG's Izzy Ross talks with Van Deel about this time in Southeast Alaska and the history of a crucial caribou hunt.
Larry Van Deel has worked as a biologist in Alaska for four decades. He spent eight of those years in Bristol Bay.
Dillingham was the highlight of my career. I got started with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in 1981 as a volunteer and then a technician.
As chairman, Van Deel runs the Board of Game meetings. This winter, the board decided to delay its schedule by a year because of logistical complications from the pandemic. Over the course of his career, Van Deel also worked in Anchorage and Kodiak, where he lives now. As a biologist, he specialized in brown bears and caribou. Now, caribou management is on the table again. In the 1990s, the Mulchatna herd in southwest Alaska was growing rapidly.
It went from about 80,000 animals to over 200,000 during the time I was there.
But it has declined severely in recent years. Surveys now show the Mulchatna herd hovers around 13,500, meaning it has shrunk by over 90% since then. Hunting for the herd is currently closed on state and federal lands. On the Board of Game, Van Deel faces pressing questions about the next management steps for the Mulchatna herd, and the board will face a question of whether the hunt will open this summer and fall. He says it will work with the tribal, state, and federal governments to make some tough decisions.
The question we have now, as far as people are concerned, is do you allow just a few folks to get the caribou, or do you completely shut it off? And by completely shutting it off, you send a very strong message to everyone that we're all in this together, and we all need to do our part to save these animals so that they can be around for future generations.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service could give permits to a local entity like a tribal council to manage a limited hunt only on federal land. The Board of Game could also offer a state hunting opportunity that takes into account traditional use. Van Deel says his time in Bristol Bay shaped his approach to wildlife management. He arrived in Dillingham in 1990, where he says he learned how to work as a biologist in the communities.
The Yupik folks out in the villages, the agency folks there in town, they taught me how to be a biologist and taught me all the stuff I learned in college was kind of neat to have as a baseline, but the real world was somewhat different, and you needed to look at the world that way.
During his time here, Van Deel says the most important thing he learned was to recognize the traditional Yupik approach to management.
Many hours in a maquet. that's what I learned. A lot of steam baths and sweating it out and having people tell me what the right way of thinking is.
He says the Kyasik Walrus Commission crystallized the difference for him between the linear Western and more holistic Yupik approaches to wildlife management. Native people traditionally hunted walrus on Round Island, in Yupik, Kyasik. It's part of a cluster of islands by Togiak. In 1960, the state designated those islands as a game sanctuary, and for three decades, no walrus hunting was allowed. In the early 1990s, Bristol Bay hunters petitioned the Board of Game to allow a subsistence walrus hunt on Round Island. 4 years later, the board granted a limited hunt. The Kyasik Commission was formed to help guide management of the traditional hunt.
In dealing with a resource that has been so important to the people of Bristol Bay, and yet it's a state wildlife sanctuary where folks were not even allowed to go after the 60s. It was a very, very bright line between the Western way of thinking about managing walrus and the Yupik way of thinking about managing walrus.
Van Deel says the Board of Game relies on advisory committees for local information about what's happening on the ground. As the climate changes, local input is particularly important. In Bristol Bay, it's changed dramatically since the 90s. A warming climate impacts species habitat, and warmer temperatures affect how people live off the land, like when they hunt in the fall.
It's still warm, and the meat is going to sour if you don't do it just right. or times when they go across the McClung River or some other river to go on a winter hunt. Now snow goes can't go past that because it's open a lot later than it used to be. So there's definitely been a change in the past 25 years that's impacting the way people use the wildlife and what the wildlife have to use.
Governor Walker appointed Vandale as a Board of Game member in 2017. His term expires this summer. Governor Dunleavy has appointed David Weiss of Wasilla to replace him. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
This is Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Seafood lovers support well-managed fisheries. More after this.
Did you know that eating wild and sustainable Alaska seafood can boost your immune system? Learn more about Alaska seafood's many proven nutritional benefits at wildalaskaseafood.com.
Seafood lovers around the world believe that the biggest threat to the oceans is pollution, followed by overfishing. Those are some of the top takeaways from a survey of over 25,000 people in 22 countries. The survey was done by the public opinion research firm Global Scan for the Marine Stewardship Council. The nonprofit MSC led the movement nearly 25 years ago towards certifying fisheries that are managed sustainably. Sourcing seafood from earth-friendly fisheries has become a requirement of doing business by most seafood buyers around the globe. The study found that 72% of seafood consumers want sustainability verifications at their supermarkets, but price is still the biggest motivator for buying decisions. 72% also agreed that buying seafood from sustainable sources will help save our oceans. 70% said people should switch their purchases to well-managed fisheries. 83% of global consumers agreed that seafood needs to be protected for future generations. 70% said they'd like to hear more from companies about their sustainability purchasing practices. Younger consumers are even more tuned in to choosing sustainable seafood, with 41% of 18 to 34-year-olds understanding what the Marine Stewardship Council label means. That younger group also showed a slightly different profile, eating less seafood on average and worrying more about the effects of climate change on the oceans than their older counterparts. Global consumers rated certification organizations third for their contribution to protecting the oceans after NGOs and scientists. Governments and large companies rated as contributing the least. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
KMXT's Island Messenger, supported in part by the Kodiak Daily Mirror, your hometown newspaper since 1940. Now online at www.kodiakdailymirror.com.
We have an abbreviated Island Messenger today. This is KMXT Kodiak 100.1 FM. It is Friday, the 26th of February, 2021. The sunrise today was at 8:11 a.m. and will set tonight at 6:36 p.m. Gives a total amount of 10 hours and 25 minutes of daylight, which is a 4-minute and 57-second gain from yesterday. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 8:08 a.m. We had a record high of 46 degrees in 1962 and a record low of negative 6 degrees in 1986. The weather outside currently in Kodiak is 46 degrees, mostly cloudy, with calm winds. Today, rain likely, mainly after 3 p.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 41 degrees. South winds 5 to 10 miles per hour and a 60% chance of precipitation. Tonight, a 40% chance of rain before 9 p.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 36 degrees. Southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming light and variable after midnight. And Saturday, scattered showers mainly after 3 p.m., mostly sunny with a high near 41 degrees, light west winds becoming northwest 5 to 10 miles per hour in the morning, and a 30% chance of precipitation. Synopsis for the North Gulf Coast and Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A front entering the western Gulf moves across the Gulf of Alaska through Saturday afternoon. A 995 millibar low forms 35 nautical miles southeast of Augustine Island Saturday morning, and moves to 55 nautical miles northeast of Middleton Island at 980 millibars by Sunday morning. Breached the Barren Island Small Craft Advisory through Saturday. Today, southwest winds 25 knots, seas 10 feet. Tonight, south winds 25 knots, except east 25 knots near the Barren Islands, seas 9 feet. From Marmot Island, Sikkenak, gale warning Saturday. Today, southwest winds 30 knots, seas 12 feet with rain. Tonight, south winds 30 knots, seas 12 feet. Virginiac Bay, Small Craft Advisory, Saturday. Today, south winds 15 knots, seas 2 feet. Tonight, south winds 15 knots, seas 2 feet. And Saturday, southwest winds 10 knots, becoming west 25 knots in the afternoon, seas 3 feet. And from Marmot Bay, Small Craft Advisory, Saturday. Today, south winds 20 knots, becoming south 10 in the afternoon, seas 4 feet, subsiding to 2 feet. And tonight, southeast winds 15 knots in the afternoon, becoming variable less than 10 knots, seas 2 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
KMXT is supported in part by Orion's Mountain Sports, featuring equipment, clothing, and footwear for your outdoor lifestyle. Orion's Mountain Sports, located at 1247 Mill Bay Road. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the February 26th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Springtime, or late winter, in Kodiak is pretty unpredictable when it comes to weather. The last week or so has been a pretty good example of that, and we're likely to enjoy pretty much all of the possible kinds of spring weather over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Moral of the story? Be prepared. Have your ice cleats handy? Don't put away the snow shovel. Keep the water and windproof shells packed in your adventure pack, and don't forget a hat. And water. It's so easy to forget to hydrate when out playing in winter, but it's just as important now as it is in summer. While the sloppy, sometimes snowy, sometimes rainy, sometimes beautifully sunny weather continues, the greenhouse and hoop house gardeners among us are ready to harvest some things already and are preparing their garden beds for others. I'm just trying to keep my houseplants alive at this point. Doing a little birding, I came across a group of Steller's eiders again. All eiders are beautiful, and two of the ones that we see here are quite large. The king eider and the common eider are recognizable from a distance, not only because they're huge, but because of the unique shape of what Jimmy Durante called the schnozola. The male king eider has a very distinctive orange bulge where the forehead meets the bill. Both the male and female common eiders have a distinctive profile where the forehead and the slope of the bill match perfectly. You could ski down those schnozolas. Not so with the Steller's eider. They have a pretty normal-looking bill and forehead. Steller's eiders can be seen from the shore here in the wintertime. Look in Trident Basin from the trails, or check in front of Cannery Row, or Gibson Cove, or inside the breakwater in Dog Bay. I've seen them in all of those spots over the years. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.